In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Professor Eric McDaniel. Today I'm joined by Dr. Joshua Blank. He's the manager of polling and research at the University of Texas Politics Project, at the Texas Politics Project here at the University of Texas. Dr. Blank, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. It's great to have you here. So let's go start with the kind of the several things we're going to talk about today. So one of the first things we're going to talk about is really what happened yesterday with the outcome of the primaries. But then also we'll talk about Mr. Trump as well. Some of the comments, some of the stuff he's said in reaction to the outcome of the Democratic primaries, but also some of his more recent controversies. And we'll also take that, some how those controversies relate to Texas, but furthermore, some of the claims that Hillary Clinton has made about the state of Texas and what she hopes to do in the presidential election. But first, let's start off with yesterday's outcome. So if we take a look, see what's going on, that Hillary Clinton has basically won California, won New Jersey, and given the number of superdelegates, has enough to win. You could argue that she won handily in California. She won by 13 points.
She got 56% of the vote.
Yeah, so she did very well in California. People thought it may be like a 52-48 split, but she did much better than
polling
expected.
Polling was really tight there up until the end, and a lot of people thought, well, she could win by 4 points, she could win by 20 points, or she could lose. That's basically what Nate Silver said. It was brilliant.
Yeah, and so it was, everything seemed erratic. And I think also one of the things that the Sanders campaign wanted was either a very close victory, for Sanders to win most, or a very close victory, so he could argue that I have momentum going into the convention. But as we can see, Hillary Clinton is basically saying, I think it's pretty much over now. And so if we roll a clip from her victory speech.
And it may be hard to see tonight, but we are all standing under a glass ceiling right now. Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee. Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible. Your efforts have produced a strong majority of the popular vote, victories in a majority of the contests, and after tonight, a majority of pledged delegates. This has been a hard-fought, deeply felt campaign. But whether you supported me, or Senator Sanders, or one of the Republicans, we all need to keep working toward a better, fairer, stronger America. Now, I know it never feels good to put your heart into a cause or a candidate you believe in and to come up short. I know that feeling well. The stakes in this election are high, and the choice is clear. Donald Trump is temperamentally unfit to be president.
Okay, so as you can see there, Hillary Clinton saying, look, we have the majority of delegates. Now, there actually is still one left. That's D.C. I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to do so well in D.C.
Also not a lot of delegates.
Yeah, also not a lot of delegates. So it's not going to be. But you can clearly see her trying to reach out to the Bernie Sanders supporters and saying, look, I know you felt passionately about this. I've been there. You know, come in. Let's hug it out. You know what I'm saying? We'll sit down, drink some fine wine, listen to Teddy Pendergrass, have some fondue, and we'll make up. All right. So
right, and this is the pivot, right? This is where she says, "Hey, Sanders supporters, come on over," as you said, right? But also, you know, first of all, let's remind everybody this is a historic candidacy. Let's galvanize a big Democratic group, which is women, right? And also at the end, let's start prosecuting the case, which is Trump is unfit to be president, which we're going to hear again and again and again. And over the last few weeks, the word they've been using a lot is thin-skinned, yeah. Right? And you're sort of thinking that they're going to start poking him, and they're going to keep poking him because they want him to kind of continue with the sort of gaffes he's been prone to produce. And so this is sort of the preview of what the general election strategy is going to look like for Clinton.
Now, Bernie Sanders also made some comments. And so let's run a clip of Bernie Sanders' comments.
We understand that our mission is more than just defeating Trump. It is transforming our country. But you all know it is more than Bernie. It is all of us together. It is what this movement is about. Next Tuesday, we continue the fight in the last primary in Washington, D.C. And then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I am pretty good in arithmetic, and I know that the fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight. But we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get.
So you see from that clip from Senator Sanders, he's clearly arguing, like, I'm gonna push this, but he also seems to be painting this as, this is more than just an election. This is a social movement. This is about a massive cultural change within America. And so in many ways, this allows him to save face that if he does lose, like, okay, look, you know, I may have lost the battle, but I have not won, I've not lost the war. And so I think this is an extremely important change we're seeing in terms, extremely important rhetoric we're seeing is like, I'm gonna keep pushing this fight because this is not about the presidency. This is about how America operates in general. I think he's dropped a lot of the language in regards to this being rigged and things of that nature because, again, the majority of pledged delegates, meaning those went in the primaries, went to Hillary Clinton. And in order for him to beat Hillary Clinton, he would have to basically recruit hundreds of superdelegates, which in many ways would be seen as usurping the will of the people. And so he's in this weird situation where you argue the superdelegates are biased against us, the superdelegates are rigging this. However, in order for him to win, he has to win over the superdelegates. And I think he can't push that any further. And he would have to win, I think, several hundred superdelegates. And considering that he wasn't a Democrat until less than a year ago, I think it's going to be a little bit difficult for them to be successful in doing that.
Right, and not only that, but the other thing is that you know, in winning over those superdelegates, his argument has to be Hillary Clinton is weak. Well, how do you make that claim when she's won more states than you have? She's won more votes than you have. She's won more pledged delegates than you have. And you're going to say, well, but you should still, superdelegates, come over and vote for me. It's a very challenging case for him to make at this point, but you're right. Now he's kind of on this outside trajectory from the campaign. We see Clinton turning towards Trump in the general election. We'll see a clip in a second where we see Trump turning towards Clinton and with some very notable features. And now at this point, Sanders is saying, what can I do with what I've done and still be effective? And people are kind of wondering, is he going to stick around? I mean, there was this sort of talk months ago about him getting out of the race. Like, he should get out of the way for Clinton. He said, no, we're going to fight this to Philadelphia. At this point, he's no longer really talking about a convention fight over the nomination. He's really trying to think about, okay, what do I do with this now? How do I leverage this into some sort of power for myself and my ideas? And so I say, you know, in the next, I think, you know, obviously through D.C., he's going to keep going on this message, but I bet after D.C., it's going to be pretty quick when he basically says, all right, now what?
Yeah, I think it's all about changing the platform of the convention. I mean, you really see the difference in terms of the number of delegates. We have a real quick, we have a slide which demonstrates the gap between Sanders and Clinton in regards to the number of pledged delegates, again, those one in the primary and the superdelegates, where you see he has a clear advantage over this. Now, if we look at the comparison of this from between 2016 and 2008, we see that the actual 2008 competition was much more intense than you're seeing here in 2016. And so, and Hillary Clinton eventually bowed out. And so Hillary Clinton is doing better against Sanders than Obama did against her in 2008. And so this argument about the lack of unity amongst the party may not necessarily be there. I mean, specifically if Sanders can push forward a few policy positions in terms of the platform of the Democratic Party in when they meet in Philadelphia, he may be able to get the Sanders supporters over there. Now, along with this, you had the reaction from, again, the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, Donald Trump, who was speaking to a crowd. And here are his comments.
I'm going to be America's champion because, you see, this election isn't about Republican or Democrat. It's about who runs this country, the special interests or the people, and I mean the American people. Every election year, politicians promise change. Obama promised change, and it didn't work out too well. And every year, they fail to deliver. Why would politicians want to change a system that's totally rigged in order to keep them in power? That's what they're doing, folks. Why would politicians want to change a system that's made them and their friends very, very wealthy? Yeah. I beat a rigged system by winning with overwhelming support, the only way you could have done it. Now, recent polls have shown that I'm beating Hillary Clinton, and with all of her many problems and the tremendous mistakes that she's made, and she has made tremendous mistakes, we expect our lead to continue to grow and grow substantially. To all of those Bernie Sanders voters who have been left out in the cold by a rigged system of superdelegates, we welcome you with open arms. My goal is always again to bring people together. But if I'm forced to fight for something I really care about, I will never, ever back down, and our country will never, ever back down. Thank you. I fought for my family. I fought for my business. I fought for my employees. And now I'm going to fight for you, the American people, like nobody has ever fought before.
What's really notable about that speech to me is the fact that, one, how bland it was, right? This was not, you know, his normal speeches, or at least the things he's been saying over the last few days that are getting all over the news. But also, the other notable thing that served to insiders is the fact that he was using a teleprompter. And that was kind of a big deal because, one, he sort of said in the past that basically teleprompters are for wusses and he doesn't need it. He can just talk for an hour off the cuff. But over the last couple weeks, he's been saying really controversial things off the cuff, and he's been getting criticized by a lot of people about them. And I think Mitch McConnell said it right, which was, you know, he needs to start acting more presidential. He needs to start prosecuting the case against Hillary Clinton. And you can see there a very tame and focused Trump. Now, the question is, how long does this last? But also, What is the teleprompter and the calm demeanor a reaction to? Everything that he said last week. So, like, what did he say over the last couple of weeks that just got him in hot water?
Well, I mean, he's made quite a few comments, specifically attacking a federal judge who's prosecuting the Trump University case. So I guess let's give a little bit of background on what Trump University is. Trump University is not a real university. It's basically a set of classes designed to help people in real estate. So Donald Trump is most famous for being a real estate mogul. The Trump University was designed as a way to teach people the skills to become, you know, millionaires like him by investing in real estate. And there's been a lot of controversy over this because people are saying, no, it was a ripoff. People were promised that they would meet Donald Trump and take a picture with him, only to find out they took a picture with a cardboard cutout of Donald Trump. That people were being hired as instructors who had no experience in real estate whatsoever. And so many people have argued that this was a con, that this was basically a way to get a bunch of my money. And so he's being sued in several states. But he's particularly gone after a federal judge in regards to this. And this is where a lot of controversy has sparked it.
So, to the extent that people started looking into this as one of his, you know, a shadier business venture, and the truth is, like, look, if anyone ever promises you that they can teach you how to be a millionaire, don't give them money.
Yes.
They don't need it, right? So, there's a lot of news media who's been looking into Trump University as they start to vet him further because he's going to be running for president. All of his business dealings are basically open to be looked at this point. And this one was particularly, unavoidable in some ways because of the type of people that these sorts of schemes tend to ensnare, right? Which is people who have less education, who are looking for a get-rich-quick scheme, that kind of thing. So they were looking into this, and then the biggest case, I guess, is in California in the district court where the judge, Gonzalo Curiel, mm-hmm. I only read, so I don't know. I think that's how you say his name, right? Donald Trump referred to him as a Mexican judge, even though he's born in Indiana. And
however, if you go to France, there is a Tex-Mex restaurant named Indiana. So maybe he spent some time in France and got Indiana and Mexico mixed up.
Okay.
The food there is horrible. Just let you know, it's horrible.
So basically, the thing that started this was that Donald Trump said, you know, he can't judge me fairly because he's Mexican. So let's see that.
I want to ask you about comments you made about the judge in the Trump University case. You said that you thought it was a conflict of interest that he was the judge because he's of Mexican heritage, even though he's from Indiana. Yeah. Hillary Clinton said that is a racist attack on a federal judge.
Oh, you know, she's so wonderful. You know, I mean, here's a woman that should be put in jail for what she did with her emails, and she's commenting on this.
Let me just tell you.
It's very simple. I have had horrible rulings. I've been treated very unfairly by this judge. Now, this judge is of Mexican heritage. I'm building a wall.
So no Mexican judge could ever be involved in a case that involves you?
He's a member of a society where, you know, very pro-Mexico, and that's fine. It's all fine.
But except that you're calling into question his heritage.
I think he should recuse himself.
Because he's
Then
Latino.
You also say, does he know the lawyer on the other side? I mean, does he know the lawyer? You know, a lot of people say
but
yes.
But I'm not talking about that.
That's another problem.
But you're invoking his race when talking about whether or not he can do his job.
I'm building a wall. I'm trying to keep business out of Mexico. Mexico's fine. There's nothing.
But he's American. He's an American.
He's of Mexican heritage, and he's very proud of it.
So this has really been a big issue, but he kind of doubles down on this over the weekend when talking about Muslim American judges. So we have a clip of that as well.
My question is, if it were a Muslim judge, would you also feel like they wouldn't be able to treat you fairly because of that policy of yours?
It's possible, yes. Yeah, that would be possible, absolutely.
Isn't there sort of a tradition, though, in America that we don't judge people by who their parents were, where they came from?
I'm not talking about tradition. I'm talking about common sense.
So this has really been a big issue for Mr. Trump and his presidential nominee, where he's basically arguing that because of somebody's religious or ethnic background, they're going to be unfair, specifically to him and his policies. Now, he has received some support from Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, has argued that the way he did it was incorrect, but there are reasons to kind of question whether or not you're receiving a fair trial. So he said, question whether or not you're receiving a fair trial is within your constitutional rights, but the way he did it was incorrect. But this also speaks to larger problems. So, for instance, if Mexican-American judges cannot, or Muslim judges cannot properly prosecute or oversee a case dealing with Donald Trump, does that also mean that white judges cannot oversee a case dealing with African Americans? Specifically, let's say if it's a Black Lives Matter protester. So this raises all kinds of questions about really the legal system. And many people have argued that what he's doing by raising these questions is he's deteriorating the legitimacy of the legal system.
Well, and to take your argument one step further, I mean, most judges, especially who deal with criminal proceedings, have very, very comfortable relationships with district attorneys. People who prosecute these cases, which is another claim that Trump is making about the judge in this case, knows the attorney on the other side, which is very common, right? But in this case, if you say if the judge knows the district attorney who's prosecuting a case, can they not sit there? Well, I mean, that's what happens in all criminal cases. So it really undermines the whole idea of the legal system. And then there are these sort of two tracks of criticism going on here. One is sort of you're talking about, you know, basically saying that a person can't judge you fairly because of their racial or ethnic background, right? Which is interesting because, I mean, it's kind of the whole thing is surreal in a lot of ways, right? Because he's saying he can't judge me because he's a Mexican, because he's of Mexican heritage, because of things I've said that might offend Mexicans or people of Mexican heritage. But I'm not a racist. I just happen to say these things that make you incapable of judging me fairly, but that's on you.
Yeah, and Speaker Paul Ryan actually denounced what he said. Now, in doing that, he also made sure to make it clear that, yes, I don't like what he said, but I am supporting Hillary Clinton. Let's roll that clip.
I disavow these requirements. I regret those comments that he made. I don't think claiming a person can't do the job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment. I think that should be absolutely disavowed. It's absolutely unacceptable. But do I believe that Hillary Clinton is the answer? No, I do not. Do I believe that Hillary Clinton is going to be the answer to solving these problems? I do not. I believe that we have more common ground on the policy issues of the day, and we have more likelihood of getting our policies enacted with him than we do with her. But I do absolutely disavow those comments. I think they're wrong. I don't think they're right-headed. And the thinking behind it is something I don't even personally relate to. But at the end of the day, this is about ideas. This is about moving our agenda forward.
So as you see, Speaker Ryan is really running, is trying to move the party as far away from those comments as possible, saying, look, we don't agree with that idea, but overall, we think he's the best candidate. And the idea is, you know, Donald Trump, what he said was, you know, was horrible. But we think if Hillary Clinton is able to get her agenda through, that's even worse. And so it's this very weird game that he's playing, where he's really trying to say that, look, we're not the party of racists. And that's something that the Democratic Party, the Republican Party is really trying to push back from. And people have been trying to be the party of racists and bigots. And then comments like this, he's like, yeah, he actually says, no, that is the textbook definition of racism. That's wrong. That should not be done. So he's openly trying to say this is not the GOP's stance. But at the same time saying that, look, but he's still our nominee. And I think even though he had a misstep here, I think in the long run, he is the best candidate.
Well, that's the thing. He's not even saying, but he's our nominee. He's saying, you know, the things that he said may be racist, but at least he's not Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's really what he's saying. And I mean, and that's actually, you know, sort of an open question. I mean, as we sort of transition here a little bit towards Texas, maybe, you know, the Trump University has a specific Texas story attached to it, right? Which is that the Texas Attorney General's office was looking into a fraud prosecution against Trump University. We have a clip that kind of goes through some of the background on this.
We open up and it really was successful from the beginning.
Trump University has drawn new attention this week thanks to a California judge's order unsealing documents in a lawsuit against the controversial training program. That attention has included Texas, where state leaders nixed a lawsuit 6 years ago against the school.
Trump University!
The decision has been tied to then-Attorney General Greg Abbott. But Friday, the former head of the AG's Consumer Protection Division, David Morales, says he, not Abbott, was the one who decided not to sue Trump U following a seven-month investigation back in 2010. Morales added the lawsuit became unnecessary when Trump U decided to leave Texas. His statement comes after several news outlets reported some AG staffers wanted to ask for a $5.4 million settlement over allegedly illegal business practices. One former deputy said his bosses gave Trump special treatment. That deputy has now received a cease and desist letter from Paxton accusing him of breaching his legal duty to keep client information confidential. Meanwhile, Abbott took to Twitter to call the stories about his involvement bogus. More than 3 years after Trump U closed up shop in Texas, Trump donated $35,000 to Abbott's campaign for governor. Critics have seized on the contribution to accuse Abbott of wrongdoing. Abbott's office says it's absurd to suggest any connection between the case and the donation.
So Greg Abbott's response is not super surprising, but also this is kind of a nice little microcosm of what you're going to see all over the country. I mean, right now, and Paul Ryan is a good example there. Paul Ryan is trying to create separation between down-ballot Republican candidates and Donald Trump, saying, hey, he may be saying these things, but he doesn't represent our party with those views, right? If you look in Texas, here's a good quick example where, you know, Trump University's connection to Texas, however tenuous it may be, is enough to say, hey, the governor did some wrongdoing. Now, the truth is, you know, $35,000 3 years later, that's a tough case to make, especially when Abbott raised, you know, close upwards of $30 million in that gubernatorial campaign. This is just a drop in the bucket for him. He's a prodigious fundraiser. He gets money from everybody. And really a part of this also is a Texas-specific thing, which is that, you know, the current Attorney General, Ken Paxton, is in so many different kind of scandals right now that even his involvement to try to hush up the person who was trying to make it, the former staffer who was trying to make this information available to the media, that just makes the media even more interested in what's going on here. So the other thing that kind of comes out of all this is, you know, Clinton's chances in Texas. And you say, well, what are Clinton's chances in Texas? Well, you know, she said a few weeks ago in a New York Magazine interview, when asked what states she might participate in or might compete in that you wouldn't expect, she instantly said Texas. And that set everybody off running to kind of like cover this as if this is a real thing. So let's, which kind of shows you how I feel about it, but let's learn a little bit about this.
Hillary Clinton says she could break what's been a lengthy Republican run in the Lone Star State. She beat Barack Obama in the Texas primary back in 2008 and fared well here against Bernie Sanders on Super Tuesday.
She beat Bernie Sanders 65-35. She does very well in small town Texas.
Former Texas Land Commissioner Gary Morrow is the chairman of Texans for Hillary.
It's very simple. You look at any poll anywhere in America, and Trump's doing very well with white males.
He says Clinton does well with groups of people. The likely GOP presidential nominee does not.
If Hillary can continue to carry African Americans overwhelmingly, can continue to carry Hispanics overwhelmingly, and continue to carry women overwhelmingly, there's not enough white males around.
That Democratic consultant is right in the sense that there aren't enough white males around in the long run, but there are a lot of white males, and in Texas there are a lot of Republicans, and they vote at higher rates than everybody else. So there's this, again, this discussion has been going on about whether Clinton can be successful in Texas, whether she can revamp the Democratic Party here. And I mean, some of that may be true. I mean, the fact is there's a reason that she mentioned Texas specifically. Part of it is that, you know, sort of this, it kind of goes back to the beginning with the superdelegates and the party regulars versus sort of the people who are really in it right now. Clinton's been in Democratic politics for a long time. She sees value in trying to build up the Democratic chances in Texas in the long run. She also knows that Texas is a place that has a lot of money, is going to donate a lot to Democrats. The fact is she needs to at least hand wave that she's going to compete here, if for no other reason than to open up people's purses, right? But the reality is that, one, it's super expensive to campaign here. The fact is she's not going to campaign in Texas over a battleground state, right? Because you have, you know, three of the biggest media markets in the country. It's not like competing here is not just like a little thing that you just decide you're going to do. The other thing is that, you know, she has about 1.25 million votes to make up. If you look back at Barack Obama's loss to Mitt Romney here in 2012, you know, additionally, you know, even if Hispanic turnout, because even if Trump's comments, you know, drive up Hispanic turnout, drive up African-American turnout, fact is that, you know, it's still not going to make up that 1.25 million votes. The final argument sort of for Hillary, of course, is, well, you know, she's, Trump is just alienating himself from Republicans. So maybe some of those white men and some of those white Republicans are going to say, no, Trump's not for me. Here's the problem with that. And we have a couple slides from Texas polling. Republicans in Texas uniformly dislike Hillary Clinton. So, you know, 91%, I think, of Texas Republicans have an unfavorable view of Hillary Clinton. Another 87% think she would make a poor or terrible president. And not only that, even if you look at the Republicans in Texas who have an unfavorable view of Trump, which in our last polling was about 41%, that'll go down in the next one now that he's the nominee. But if you look at the even just those Republicans who don't like Trump, they dislike Hillary Clinton even more than Republicans overall. So about 92-95% of them say they have an unfavorable view of Clinton. So it's not as though these people are going to go start running to Clinton's camp and she's just going to surprise everybody here in November. Sorry.
No, I mean, I agree. I think Hillary Clinton has the same chance of winning Texas as I do of becoming a Chippendales dancer by the November election.
Don't sell yourself short.
I can work hard, and I might have a chance. You know, I might actually get an audition. You know what I'm saying? They call me Chocolate Thunder for a reason. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, if you look at Wendy Davis's campaign, well, that's a horrible example to give because I think Wendy Davis's campaign was like, hey, how not to run a campaign?
But you know the thing about Wendy Davis that's funny is there's this other claim about Hillary Clinton in Texas, which is that, you know, she has a special connection to Texas. She and Bill do because they were registering, you know, Hispanic voters back in the 70s, which is kind of a crazy claim to make that now she has, because of that, she has this strong connection. But actually, if you look at her favorability among Democrats, she actually right now is 2 points lower than Wendy Davis was when Wendy Davis was running for governor. So there's this idea that Hillary Clinton is just somehow fundamentally different, that she's got this, you know, this extra connection here in Texas. And again, you bring up Wendy Davis as a great counterexample. Wendy Davis looked better than Hillary Clinton, and she lost soundly to Greg Abbott.
Yeah, so these are some of the things that we would like for you to pay attention to in the news and, again, keep track of as things are going on. So we'll see you here next week, and have a good week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.